any stage of development is accomplished by apportioning the metabolic energy being delivered through networks to existing cells to the production of new cells that build up new tissue. This process can be analyzed using the network theory to predict a universal quantitative theory of growth curves applicable to any organism, including tumors. A growth curve is simply a graph of the size of the organism plotted as a function of its age. You are probably familiar with growth curves if you have had children, as pediatricians routinely show them to parents so that they can see how their child's development compares with the expectations for the average infant. The growth theory also explains a curious paradoxical phenomenon that you might have pondered, namely, why we eventually stop growing, even though we continue to eat. This turns out to be a consequence of the sublinear scaling of metabolic rate and the economies of scale embodied in the network design. In a later chapter, the same paradigm will be applied to the growth of cities, companies, and economies to understand the fundamental question as to the origins of open-ended growth and its possible sustainability. Because networks determine the rates at which energy and resources are delivered to cells, they set the pace of all physiological processes. Because cells are constrained to operate systematically slower in larger organisms relative to smaller ones, the pace of life systematically decreases with increasing size. Thus, large mammals live longer, take longer to mature, have slower heart rates, and cells that don't work as hard as those of small mammals, all to the same predictable degree. Small creatures live life in the fast lane, while large ones move ponderously, though more efficiently, through life. Think of a scurrying mouse relative to a sauntering elephant. Having established this way of thinking, the scene will shift to ask how the network and scaling paradigm, successfully established in the biological arena, can be fruitfully applied to ask similar questions about the dynamics, growth, and structure of cities and companies with a view to developing an analogous mechanistic science of cities and companies. This will in turn be used as a point of departure for addressing the big questions of global sustainability and the challenge of continuous innovation and the increasing pace of life. 8. Cities and Global Sustainability, Innovation and Cycles of Singularities. Scaling as a manifestation of an underlying network theory implies that, despite external appearances and habitats, a whale is, to a good approximation, a scaled-up elephant. An elephant is a scaled-up dog, and a dog is, in turn, a scaled-up mouse, when viewed in terms of their measurable characteristics and traits. At an 80-90% level, they are scaled versions of one another, following predictable, non-linear mathematical rules. Put slightly differently, all mammals that have ever existed, including you and me, are, on average, approximately scaled versions of a single, idealized mammal. Could this be true of cities and companies? Is New York a scaled-up San Francisco, which is a scaled-up Boise, which is a scaled-up Santa Fe? Is Tokyo a scaled-up Osaka, which is a scaled-up Kyoto, which is a scaled-up Tsukuba? Even within their own national urban systems, all of these cities surely look different from one another, and each has a different history, geography, and culture. However, the same could have been said of whales, horses, dogs, and mice. The only way to answer such questions seriously is to look at data. Remarkably, analyses of such data show that, as a function of population size, city infrastructure, such as the length of roads, electrical cables, water pipes, and the number of gas stations, scales in the same way whether in the United States, China, Japan, Europe, or Latin America. As in biology, these quantities scale sublinearly with size, indicating a systematic economy of scale, but with an exponent of about 0.85 rather than 0.75. So, for example, across the globe, fewer roads and electrical cables are needed per capita the bigger the city, Like organisms, cities are indeed approximately scaled versions of one another, despite their different histories, geographies, and cultures, at least as far as their physical infrastructure is concerned. Perhaps even more remarkably, they are also scaled socio-economic versions of one another. Socio-economic quantities, such as wages, wealth, patents, AIDS cases, crime, and educational institutions, which have no analogue in biology and did not exist on the planet before humans invented cities 10,000 years ago, also scale with population size, but with a superlinear, meaning bigger than one, exponent of approximately 1.15. An example of this is the number of patents produced in a city. Thus, on a per capita basis, all of these quantities systematically increase to the same degree as city size increases, and at the same time, there are equivalent savings from economies of scale in all infrastructural quantities. Despite their amazing diversity and complexity across the globe, and despite localized urban planning, cities manifest a surprising coarse-grained simplicity, regularity, and predictability. To put it in simple terms, scaling implies that if a city is twice the size of another city in the same country, whether 40,000 versus 20,000, or 4 million versus 2 million, then its wages, wealth, number of patents, AIDS cases, violent crime, and educational institutions all increase by approximately the same degree, by about 15% above mere doubling, with similar savings in all of its infrastructure. The bigger the city, the more the average individual systematically owns, produces, and consumes, whether goods, resources, or ideas. The good, the bad, and the ugly are integrated in an approximately predictable package. A person may move to a bigger city drawn by more innovation, a greater sense of action, and higher wages, but she can also expect to confront an equivalent increase in the prevalence of crime and disease. The fact that the same scaling laws are observed for diverse urban metrics in cities and urban systems that evolved independently across the globe strongly suggests that, as in biology, there are underlying generic principles transcending history, geography, and culture, and that a fundamental, coarse-grained theory of cities is possible. In Chapter 8, I will discuss how the inextricable tension between benefits and costs of social and infrastructural networks has its origins in the underlying universal dynamics of social network structures and group clustering of human interactions. Cities provide a natural mechanism for reaping the benefits of high social connectivity among very different people conceiving and solving problems in a diversity of ways. I will discuss the nature and dynamics of these social network structures and show how scaling laws emerge, including the intriguing link between the 15% enhancement of all socio-economic activities, whether good or bad, and the equivalent 15% savings on physical infrastructure. When humans began forming sizable communities, they brought a fundamentally new dynamic to the planet. With the invention of language and the consequent exchange of information in social network space, we discovered how to innovate and create wealth and ideas, ultimately manifested in superlinear scaling. In biology, network dynamics constrains the pace of life to decrease systematically with increasing size following the one-quarter power scaling laws. In contrast, the dynamics of social networks underlying wealth creation and innovation lead to the opposite behavior, namely the systematically increasing pace of life as city size increases. Diseases spread faster, businesses are born and die more often, commerce is transacted more rapidly, and people even walk faster, all following the approximate 15% rule. We all sense that life is faster in the big city than in the small town, and that it has ubiquitously accelerated during our lifetimes, as cities and their economies grew. Resources and energy are the necessary fuel for growth. In biology, growth is driven by metabolism, whose sublinear scaling leads to a predictable, approximately stable size at maturity. Such a behaviour would be considered a disaster in traditional economic thinking, where healthy economies, whether for cities or nations, are characterised by continuous, open-ended, exponential expansion of at least a few percent per annum ad infinitum. Just as bounded growth in biology follows from the sublinear scaling of metabolic rate, the superlinear scaling of wealth creation and innovation, as measured by patent production, for example, leads to unbounded, often faster than exponential growth, consistent with open-ended economies. This is satisfyingly consistent, but there's a big catch, which goes under the forbidding technical name of a finite time singularity. In a nutshell, the problem is that the theory also predicts that unbounded growth cannot be sustained without having either infinite resources or inducing major paradigm shifts that reset the clock before potential collapse occurs. We have sustained open-ended growth and avoided collapse by invoking continuous cycles of paradigm-shifting innovations, such as those associated on the big scale of human history with discoveries of iron, steam, coal, computation, and, most recently, digital information technology. Indeed, the litany of such discoveries, both large and small, is testament to the extraordinary ingenuity of the collective human mind. Unfortunately, however, there is another serious catch. Theory dictates that such discoveries must occur at an increasingly accelerating pace. The time between successive innovations must systematically and inextricably get shorter and shorter. For instance, the time between the computer age and the information and digital age was perhaps 20 years, in contrast to the thousands of years between the stone, bronze, and iron ages. If we therefore insist on continuous open-ended growth, not only does the pace of life inevitably quicken, but we must innovate at a faster and faster rate. We are all too familiar with its short-term manifestation in the increasingly faster pace at which new gadgets and models appear. It's as if we are on a succession of accelerating treadmills and have to jump from one to another at an ever-increasing rate. This is clearly not sustainable, potentially leading to the collapse of the entire urbanized socio-economic fabric. Innovation and wealth creation that fuel social systems, if left unchecked, potentially sow the seeds of their inevitable collapse. Can this be avoided? Or are we locked into a fascinating experiment in natural selection that is doomed to fail? 9. Companies and businesses. It is natural to extend these ideas to ask how they might relate to companies. Could there possibly be a quantitative, predictive science of companies? Do companies manifest systematic regularities that transcend their size and business character? For example, in terms of sales and assets, are Walmart and Exxon, whose revenues exceed $500 billion, approximately scaled-up versions of smaller companies with sales of less than $10 million? Amazingly, the answer to this is yes. Like organisms and cities, companies also scale as simple power laws. Equally surprising is that they scale sublinearly as functions of their size, rather than superlinearly like socio-economic metrics in cities. In this sense, companies are much more like organisms than cities. The scaling exponent for companies is around 0.9, to be compared with 0.85 for the infrastructure of cities and 0.75 for organisms. However, there is considerably more variation around precise scaling among companies than for organisms or cities. This is especially so in their early stages of development as they jostle for a place in the market. Nevertheless, the surprising regularity manifested in their average behavior suggests that, despite their broad diversity and apparent individuality, companies grow and function under general constraints and principles that transcend their size and business sector. For organisms, The sublinear scaling of metabolic rate underlies their cessation of growth and a size at maturity that remains approximately stable until death. A similar life history trajectory is at work for companies. They grow rapidly in their early years, but taper off as they mature, and if they survive, eventually stop growing relative to the GDP. In their youth, many are dominated by a spectrum of innovative ideas as they seek to optimize their place in the market. However, as they grow and become more established, the spectrum of their product space inevitably narrows, and at the same time, they need to build a significant administration and bureaucracy. Relatively quickly, economies of scale and sublinear scaling, reflecting the challenge of efficiently administering a large and complex organization, dominate innovation and ideas encapsulated in superlinear scaling, ultimately leading to stagnation and to mortality. Half of all the companies in any given cohort of U.S. publicly traded companies disappear within 10 years. And a scant few make it to 50, let alone 100 years. As they grow, companies tend to be more and more unidimensional, driven partly by market forces, but also by the inevitable ossification of the top-down administrative and bureaucratic needs perceived as necessary for operating a traditional company in the modern era. Change, adaptation, and reinvention become increasingly difficult to affect, especially as the external socioeconomic clock is continually accelerating and conditions change at a faster and faster rate. Cities, on the other hand, become increasingly multidimensional as they grow in size. Indeed, in stark contrast to almost all companies, the diversity of cities, as measured by the number of different kinds of jobs and businesses that comprise their economic landscape, continually and systematically increases in a predictable way with increasing city size. From this perspective, it comes as no surprise that the growth and mortality curves of companies closely resemble the corresponding growth and mortality curves of organisms. Both cases exhibit systematic sublinear scaling, economies of scale, bounded growth, and finite lifespans. Furthermore, in both cases, the probability of dying, usually referred to as the mortality rate, which is the rate at which deaths are occurring relative to the number still alive, is the same, no matter the age of either the animal or the company. Publicly traded companies die through acquisitions, mergers, and bankruptcies at the same rate, regardless of how well established they are or what they actually do. The mechanistic basis for understanding the growth, mortality, and organizational dynamics of companies, comparing and contrasting them with the growth and mortality of organisms, and the unbounded growth and apparent immortality of cities, will be discussed in greater detail in Chapter 9. Chapter 2. The Measure of All Things. An Introduction to Scaling. Before turning to the many issues and questions raised in the opening chapter, I want to devote this chapter to a broad introduction to some of the basic concepts used throughout the rest of the book. Although some listeners may well be familiar with some of this material, I want to make sure we're all on the same page. The overview is primarily from a historical perspective, beginning with Galileo explaining why there can't be giant insects, and ending with Lord Rayleigh explaining why the sky is blue. In between, I will touch upon Superman, LSD and drug dosages, body mass indices, chip disasters, and the origin of modeling theory, and how all of these are related to the origins and nature of innovation and limits to growth. Above all, I want to use these examples to convey the conceptual power of thinking quantitatively in terms of scale. 1. From Godzilla to Galileo. From time to time, like many scientists, I receive requests from journalists asking for an interview, usually about some question or problem related to cities, urbanization, the environment, sustainability, complexity, the Santa Fe Institute, or, occasionally, even about the Higgs particle. Imagine my surprise, then, when I was contacted by a journalist from the magazine Popular Mechanics, informing me that Hollywood was going to release a new blockbuster version of the classic Japanese film Godzilla, and that she was interested in getting my views on it. You may recall that Godzilla is an enormous monster that mostly roams around cities. Tokyo, in the original 1954 version, causing destruction and havoc while terrorizing the populace. The journalist had heard that I knew something about scaling and wanted to know, in a fun, goofy, nerdy sort of way, about the biology of Godzilla, to tie in with the release of the new movie, how fast such a large animal would walk, how much energy his metabolism would generate, how much he would weigh, etc. Naturally, this new 21st-century All-American Godzilla was the biggest incarnation of the character yet, reaching a lofty height of 350 feet, 106 meters, more than twice the height of the original Japanese version, which was only 164 feet, 50 meters. I immediately responded by telling the journalist that almost any scientist she contacted would tell her that no such beast as Godzilla could actually exist, because if it were made of pretty much the same basic stuff as we are, meaning all of life, it could not function, because it would collapse under its own weight. The scientific argument upon which this is based was articulated more than 400 years ago by Galileo at the dawn of modern science. It is, in its very essence, an elegant scaling argument. Galileo asked what happens if you try to indefinitely scale up an animal, a tree, or a building, and with his response, discovered that there are limits to growth. His argument set the basic template for all subsequent scaling arguments right up to the present day. For good reason, Galileo is often referred to as the father of modern science, for his many seminal contributions to physics, mathematics, astronomy, and philosophy. He is perhaps best known for his mythical experiments dropping objects of different sizes and compositions from the top of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, to show that they all reached the ground at the same time. This non-intuitive observation contradicted the accepted Aristotelian dogma that heavy objects fall faster than lighter ones in direct proportion to their weight, a fundamental misconception that was universally believed for almost 2,000 years before Galileo actually tested it. It is amazing in retrospect that, until Galileo's investigations, no one seems to have thought of, let alone bothered testing this apparently self-evident fact. Galileo's experiment revolutionized our fundamental understanding of motion and dynamics, and paved the way for Newton to propose his famous laws of motion. These laws led to a precise quantitative mathematical predictive framework for understanding all motion, whether here on Earth or across the universe, thereby uniting the heavens and Earth under the same natural laws. This not only redefined man's place in the universe, but provided the gold standard for all subsequent science, including setting the stage for the coming of the Age of Enlightenment and the technological revolution of the past 200 years. Galileo is also famous for perfecting the telescope and discovering the moons of Jupiter, which convinced him of the Copernican view of the solar system. By continuing to insist on a heliocentric view derived from his observations, Galileo was to end up paying a heavy price. At the age of 69, and in poor health, he was brought before the Inquisition and found guilty of heresy. He was forced to recant, and after a brief imprisonment, spent the rest of his life under house arrest, 9 more years, during which he went blind. His books were banned, and put on the Vatican's infamous Index Librorum Prohibitorum. It wasn't until 1835, more than 200 years later, that his works were finally dropped from the index, and until 1992, almost 400 years later, and for Pope John Paul II to publicly express regret for how Galileo had been treated. It is sobering to realize that words written long ago in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, based on opinion, intuition, and prejudice, can so overwhelmingly outweigh scientific observational evidence and the logic and language of mathematics. Sad to say, we are hardly free from such misguided thinking today. Despite the terrible tragedy that befell Galileo, humanity reaped a wonderful benefit from his incarceration. It may very well have happened anyway, but it was while he was under house arrest that he wrote what is perhaps his finest work, one of the truly great books in the scientific literature, titled Discourses and Mathematical Demonstrations Relating to Two New Sciences. The book is basically his legacy from the preceding 40 years, during which he grappled with how to systematically address the challenge of understanding the natural world around us in a logical, rational framework. As such, it laid the groundwork for the equally monumental contribution of Isaac Newton, and pretty much for all of the science that followed. Indeed, in praising the book, Einstein was not exaggerating when he called Galileo the father of modern science. It's a great book. Despite its forbidding title and somewhat archaic language and style, it's surprisingly readable and a lot of fun. It is written in the style of a discourse between three men, Simplicio, Sagredo, and Salviati, who meet over 4 days to discuss and debate the various questions, big and small, that Galileo is seeking to answer. Simplicio represents the ordinary layperson, who is curious about the world and asks a series of apparently naive questions. Salviati is the smart fellow, Galileo, with all of the answers, which are presented in a compelling but patient manner, while Sagredo is the middleman who alternates between challenging Salviati and encouraging Simplicio. On the second day of their discourse, they turn their attention to what appears to be a somewhat arcane discussion on the strength of ropes and beams. And just as you are wondering where this somewhat tedious, detailed discussion is going, the fog clears, the lights flash, and Salviati makes the following pronouncement. From what has already been demonstrated, you can plainly see the impossibility of increasing the size of structures to vast dimensions, either in art or in nature. Likewise, the impossibility of building ships, palaces, or temples of enormous size in such a way that their oars, yards, beams, iron bolts, and, in short, all their other parts will hold together. Nor can nature produce trees of extraordinary size because the branches would break down under their own weight. So, also it would be impossible to build up the bony structures of men, horses, or other animals so as to hold together and perform their normal functions, if these animals were to be increased enormously in height. For if his height be increased inordinately, he will fall and be crushed under his own weight. There it is. Our paranoid fantasies of giant ants, beetles, spiders, or, for that matter, Godzillas, so graphically displayed by the comic and film industries, had already been conjectured nearly 400 years ago by Galileo, who then brilliantly demonstrates that they are a physical impossibility. Or, more precisely, that there are fundamental constraints as to how large they can actually get. So many such science fiction images are indeed just that. Fiction. Galileo's argument is elegant and simple, yet it has profound implications. Furthermore, it provides an excellent introduction to many of the concepts we'll be investigating in the following chapters. It consists of two parts: a geometrical argument showing how areas and volumes associated with any object scale as its size increases, and a structural argument showing that the strength of pillars holding up buildings, limbs supporting animals, or trunks supporting trees is proportional to their cross-sectional areas. This is a non-technical version of the first of Galileo's arguments on how areas and volumes scale. If, for example, the shape of an object is kept fixed, then when it is scaled up, all of its areas increase as the square of its lengths, while all of its volumes increase as the cube. To begin, Consider one of the simplest possible geometrical objects, namely a floor tile in the shape of a square, and imagine scaling it up to a larger size. To be specific, let's take the length of its sides to be 1 foot, so that its area, obtained by multiplying the length of two adjacent sides together, is 1 foot multiplied by 1 foot, equals 1 square foot. Now, suppose we double the length of all of its sides from 1 to 2 feet. Then its area increases to 2 feet multiplied by 2 feet equals 4 square feet. Similarly, if we were to triple the lengths to 3 feet, then its area would increase to 9 square feet, and so on. The generalization is clear. The area increases with the square of the lengths. This relationship remains valid for any two-dimensional geometric shape, and not just for squares. Provided that the shape is kept fixed when all of its linear dimensions are increased by the same factor. A simple example is a circle. If its radius is doubled, for instance, then its area increases by a factor of 2 times 2 equals 4. A more general example is that of doubling the dimensions of every length in your house while keeping its shape and structural layout the same, in which case the area of all of its surfaces, such as its walls and floors, would increase by a factor of 4. This argument can be straightforwardly extended from areas to volumes. Consider first a simple cube. If the lengths of its sides are increased by a factor of 2 from, say, 1 foot to 2 feet, then its volume increases from 1 cubic foot to 2 times 2 times 2 equals 8 cubic feet. Similarly, if the lengths are increased by a factor of 3, the volume increases by a factor of 3 times 3 times 3 equals 27. As with areas, this can straightforwardly be generalized to any object, regardless of its shape, provided we keep it fixed, to conclude that if we scale it up, its volume increases with the cube of its linear dimensions. Thus, when an object is scaled up in size, its volumes increase at a much faster rate than its areas. Let me give a simple example. If you double the dimensions of every length in your house, keeping its shape the same, then its volume increases by a factor of 2 to the third, equals 8, while its floor area increases by only a factor of 2 to the second, equals 4. To take a much more extreme case, suppose all of its linear dimensions were increased by a factor of 10. Then all surface areas, such as floors, walls, and ceilings, would increase by a factor of 10 times 10 equals 100. That is, 100-fold. Whereas the volumes of its rooms would increase by the much larger factor of 10 times 10 times 10 equals 1,000. 1,000-fold. This has huge implications for the design and functionality of much of the world around us. Whether it's the buildings we live and work in, or the structure of the animals and plants of the natural world. For instance, most heating, cooling, and lighting is proportional to the corresponding surface areas of the heaters, air conditioners, and windows. Their effectiveness therefore increases much more slowly than the volume of living space needed to be heated, cooled, or lit. So these need to be disproportionately increased in size when a building is scaled up. Similarly, for large animals, the need to dissipate heat generated by their metabolism and physical activity can become problematic, because the surface area through which it is dissipated is proportionately much smaller relative to their volume than for smaller ones. Elephants, for example, have solved this challenge by evolving disproportionately large ears to significantly increase their surface area so as to dissipate more heat. This essential difference in the way areas and volumes scale was very likely appreciated by many people before Galileo. His additional new insight was to combine this geometric realization with his realization that the strength of pillars, beams, and limbs is determined by the size of their cross-sectional areas, and not by how long they are. Thus, a post whose rectangular cross-section is 2 inches by 4 inches, equals 8 square inches, can support 4 times the weight of a similar post of the same material, whose cross-sectional dimensions are only half as big, namely 1 inch by 2 inches, equals 2 square inches, regardless of the length of either post. The first could be 4 feet long and the second 7 feet, it doesn't matter. That's why builders, architects, and engineers involved in construction classify wood by its cross-sectional dimensions, and why lumber yards at Home Depot and Lowe's display them as 2x2s, 2x4s, 4x4s, and so on. Now, as we scale up a building or an animal, their weights increase in direct proportion to their volumes, provided, of course, that the materials they're made of don't change, so that their densities remain the same. So, doubling the volume doubles the weight. Thus, the weight being supported by a pillar or a limb increases much faster than the corresponding increase in strength, because weight, like volume, scales as the cube of the linear dimensions, whereas strength increases only as the square. To emphasize this point, consider increasing the height of a building or tree by a factor of 10, keeping its shape the same. Then, the weight needed to be supported increases 1,000-fold, 10 to the third, whereas the strength of the pillar or trunk holding it up increases by only 100-fold, 10 to the second. Thus, the ability to safely support the additional weight is only a tenth of what it had previously been. Consequently, if the size of the structure, whatever it is arbitrarily increased, it will eventually collapse under its own weight. There are limits to size and growth. To put it slightly differently, relative strength becomes progressively weaker as size increases. Or, as Galileo so graphically put it, the smaller the body, the greater its relative strength. Thus, a small dog could probably carry on his back 2 or 3 dogs of his own size, but I believe that a horse could not carry even 1 of his own size. 2. Misleading conclusions and misconceptions of scale. Superman. Superman made his earthly debut in 1938, and still remains one of the great icons of the sci-fi fantasy world. He had arrived as a baby from the planet Krypton, whose inhabitants' physical structure was millions of years advanced of our own. Upon reaching maturity, the people of his race became gifted with titanic strength. Indeed, upon maturity, Superman could easily leap 1/8 of a mile, hurdle a 20-story building, raise tremendous weights, run faster than an express train. All triumphantly summed up in the famous introduction to the radio serials, and subsequent TV series and films. Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. It's Superman. All of which may well be true. However, in the last frame of that first page there is another bold pronouncement, so important that it warranted being put in capital letters, a scientific explanation of Clark Kent's amazing strength. Incredible? No. For even today, on our world exist creatures with super strength. To support this, 2 examples are given. The lowly ant can support weights hundreds of times its own, and the grasshopper leaps what to man would be the space of several city blocks. As persuasive as these examples might appear to be, they represent a classic case of misconceived and misleading conclusions drawn from correct facts. Ants appear to be, at least superficially, much stronger than human beings. However, as we have learned from Galileo, relative strength systematically increases as size decreases. Consequently, scaling down from a dog to an ant, following the simple rules of how strength scales with size, will show that if a small dog could probably carry on his back 2 or 3 dogs of his own size, then an ant can carry on his back 100 ants of his size. Furthermore, because we are about 10 million times heavier than an average ant, the same argument shows that we are capable of carrying only about one other person on ours. Thus, ants have, in fact, the correct strength appropriate for a creature of their size, just as we do. So there's nothing extraordinary or surprising about their lifting 100 times their own weight. The misconception arises because of the natural propensity to think linearly, as encapsulated in the implicit presumption that doubling the size of an animal leads to a doubling of its strength. If this were so, then we would be 10 million times stronger than ants and be able to lift about a ton, corresponding to our being able to lift more than 10 other people, just like Superman. 3. Orders of magnitude, logarithms, earthquakes, and the Richter scale. We just saw that if the lengths of an object are increased by a factor of 10 without changing its shape or composition, then its areas, and therefore strengths, increase by a factor of 100, and its volumes, and therefore weights, by a factor of 1,000. Successive powers of 10, such as these, are called orders of magnitude, and are typically expressed in a convenient shorthand notation as 10 to the first, 10 to the second, 10 to the third, etc., with the exponent, the little superscript on the 10, denoting the number of zeros following the 1. Thus, 10 to the 6th is shorthand for a million, or 6 orders of magnitude, because it is 1 followed by 6 zeros. 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. In this language, Galileo's result can be expressed as saying that for every order of magnitude increase in length, areas and strengths increase by 2 orders of magnitude, whereas volumes and weights increase by 3 orders of magnitude, from which it follows that for a single order of magnitude increase in area, volumes increase by 3/2, that is 1.5 orders of magnitude. A similar relationship therefore holds between strength and weight. For every order of magnitude increase in strength, the weight that can be supported increases by 1.5 orders of magnitude. Conversely, if the weight is increased by a single order of magnitude, then the strength only increases by 2/3 of an order of magnitude. This is the essential manifestation of a non-linear relationship. A linear relationship would have meant that for every order of magnitude increase in area, the volume would have also increased by 1 order of magnitude. Even though many of us may not be aware of it, we have all been exposed to the concept of orders of magnitude, including fractions of orders of magnitude, through the reporting of earthquakes in the media. Not infrequently, we hear news announcements along the lines that there was a moderate-size earthquake today in Los Angeles that measured 5.7 on the Richter scale, which shook many buildings but caused only minor damage. And occasionally we hear of earthquakes such as the one in the Northridge region of Los Angeles in 1994, which was only a single unit larger on the Richter scale, but caused enormous amounts of damage. The Northridge earthquake, whose magnitude was 6.7, caused more than $20 billion worth of damage, including 60 fatalities, making it one of the costliest natural disasters in U.S. history, whereas a 5.7 earthquake caused only negligible damage. The reason for this vast difference in impact, despite an apparently small increase in magnitude, is that the Richter scale expresses size in terms of orders of magnitude. So, an increase of one unit actually means an increase of one order of magnitude, so that a 6.7 earthquake is actually 10 times the size of a 5.7 earthquake. Likewise, a 7.7 earthquake, such as the Sumatra one of 2010, is 10 times bigger than the Northridge quake, and 100 times bigger than a 5.7 earthquake. The Sumatra earthquake was in a relatively unpopulated area, but still caused widespread destruction via a tsunami that displaced more than 20,000 people and killed almost 500. Sadly, 5 years earlier, Sumatra had suffered an even more destructive earthquake, whose magnitude was 8.7, and therefore yet another 10 times larger. Obviously, in addition to its size, the destruction wreaked by an earthquake depends a great deal on the local conditions, such as population size and density, the robustness of buildings and infrastructure, and so on. The 1994 Northridge earthquake and the more recent 2011 Fukushima one, both of which caused huge amounts of damage, were only 6.7 and 6.6, respectively. The Richter scale actually measures the shaking amplitude of the earthquake recorded on a seismometer. The corresponding amount of energy released scales non-linearly with this amplitude, in such a way that for every order of magnitude increase in the measured amplitude, the energy released increases by 1.5, that is, 3/2, orders of magnitude. This means that a difference of 2 orders of magnitude in the amplitude, that is a change of 2.0 on the Richter scale, is equivalent to a factor of 3 orders of magnitude, 1,000, in the energy released. While a change of just 1.0 is equivalent to a factor of the square root of 1,000, equals 31.6^4. Just to give some idea of the enormous amounts of energy involved in earthquakes, here are some numbers to peruse. The energy released by the detonation of a pound, or 0.5 kilogram of TNT, corresponds roughly to a magnitude of 1 on the Richter scale. A magnitude of 3 corresponds to about 1,000 pounds, or about 500 kilograms of TNT, which was roughly the size of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. 5.7 corresponds to about 5,000 tons. 6.7 to about 170,000 tons. The Northridge and Fukushima earthquakes. 7.7 to about 5.4 million tons. The 2010 Sumatra earthquake. And 8.7 to about 170 million tons, the 2005 Sumatra earthquake. The most powerful earthquake ever recorded was the Great Chilean earthquake of 1960 in Valdivia, which registered 9.5, corresponding to 2,700 million tons of TNT, almost 1,000 times larger than Northridge or Fukushima. For comparison, the atomic bomb, Little Boy, that was dropped on Hiroshima in 1945, released the energy equivalent of about 15,000 tons of TNT. A typical hydrogen bomb releases well over 1,000 times more, corresponding to a major earthquake of magnitude 8. These are enormous amounts of energy when you realize that 170 million tons of TNT, the size of the 2005 Sumatra earthquake, can fuel a city of 15 million people, equivalent to the entire New York City metropolitan area, for an entire year. This kind of scale, where instead of increasing linearly, as in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we increase by factors of 10, as in the Richter scale, 10 to the first, 10 to the second, 10 to the third, 10 to the fourth, 10 to the fifth, is called logarithmic. Notice that it's actually linear in terms of the numbers of orders of magnitude, as indicated by the exponents, the superscripts, on the tens. Among its many attributes, a logarithmic scale allows one to plot quantities that differ by huge factors on the same axis, such as those between the magnitudes of the Valdivia earthquake, the Northridge earthquake, and a stick of dynamite, which overall cover a range of more than 1 billion. 10 to the ninth. This would be impossible if a linear plot was used, because almost all of the events would pile up at the lower end of the graph. To include all earthquakes, which range over 5 or 6 orders of magnitude on a linear plot, would require a piece of paper several miles long. Hence, the invention of the Richter scale. Because it conveniently allows quantities that vary over a vast range to be represented on a line on a single page of paper such as this, the logarithmic technique is ubiquitously used across all areas of science. the brightness of stars, the acidity of chemical solutions, their pH, physiological characteristics of animals, and the GDPs of all countries are all examples where this technique is commonly utilized to cover the entire spectrum of the variation of the quantity being investigated. 4. Pumping iron and testing Galileo. An essential component of science that often distinguishes it from other intellectual pursuits is its insistence that hypothesized claims be verified by experiment and observation. This is highly non-trivial, as evidenced by the fact that it took more than 2,000 years before Aristotle's pronouncement that objects falling under gravity do so at a rate proportional to their weight to actually be tested, and when carried out, to be found wanting. Sadly, many of our present-day dogmas and beliefs, especially in the non-scientific realm, remain untested, yet rigidly adhered to, without any serious attempt to verify them, sometimes with unfortunate or even devastating consequences. So, following our detour into powers of 10, I want to use what we've learned about orders of magnitude and logarithms to address the issue of checking Galileo's predictions about how strength should scale with weight. Can we show that in the real world, strength really does increase with weight according to the rule that it should do so in the ratio of 2 to 3 when expressed in terms of orders of magnitude? In 1956, the chemist M. H. Leetsky devised a simple and elegant confirmation of Galileo's prediction. He realized that competitive weightlifting across different weight classes provides us with a data set of how maximal strength scales with body size, at least among human beings. All champion weightlifters try to maximize how big a load they can lift, and to accomplish this, they have all trained with pretty much the same intensity and to the same degree. So, if we compare their strengths, we do so under approximately similar conditions. Furthermore, championships are decided by 3 different kinds of lifts: the press, the snatch, and the clean and jerk. So, taking the total of these effectively averages over individual variation of specific talents. These totals are therefore a good measure of maximal strength. Using the totals of these 3 lifts from the weightlifting competition in the 1956 Olympic Games, Leetsky brilliantly confirmed the 2/3 prediction for how strength should scale with body weight. The totals for the individual gold medal winners were plotted logarithmically versus their body weight, where each axis represented increases by factors of 10. If strength, which is plotted along the vertical axis, increases by 2 orders of magnitude for every 3 orders of magnitude increase in body weight, which is plotted along the horizontal axis, then the data should exhibit a straight line whose slope is 2/3. The measured value found by Leetsky was 0.675, very close to the prediction of 2/3 equals 0.667. 5. Individual performance and deviations from scaling. The strongest man in the world. The regularity exhibited by the weightlifting data, and its close agreement with the 2/3 prediction for the scaling of strength, might seem surprising given the simplicity of the scaling argument. After all, each of us has a slightly different shape, different body characteristics, different history, slightly different genetics, and so on, none of which is accounted for in the derivation of the 2/3 prediction. Using the total sum of the weights lifted by champions, who have trained to approximately the same degree, helps us to average over some of these individual differences. On the other hand, all of us are to a good approximation made of pretty much the same stuff with very similar physiologies. We function very similarly, and are approximate scaled versions of one another, at least as far as strength is concerned. Indeed, by the end of the book, I hope to convince you that this broad similarity extends to almost every aspect of your physiology and life history. So much so, in fact, that when I talk about we being approximately scaled versions of one another, I will mean not just all human beings, but all mammals, and, to varying degrees, all of life. Another way of viewing these scaling laws is that they provide an idealized baseline that captures the dominant, essential features that unite us not only as human beings, but also as variations on being an organism and an expression of life. Each individual, each species, even each taxonomic group deviates to varying degrees from the idealized norms manifested by the scaling laws, with deviations reflecting the specific characteristics that represent individuality. Let me illustrate this using the weightlifting example. When you plot body weight of half a dozen weightlifters against the strength of each, measured in how much he can lift, you can clearly see that these weightlifters are lifting almost precisely what they should for their body weights. However, notice that the remaining two, the heavyweight and the middleweight, both lie just a little off the line, one below and one above. Thus the heavyweight, even though he has lifted more than anyone else, is actually underperforming relative to what he should be lifting given his weight, whereas the middleweight is overperforming relative to his weight. In other words, from the egalitarian level playing field perspective of a physicist, the strongest man in the world in 1956 was actually the middleweight champion, because he was overperforming relative to his weight. Ironically, the weakest of all of the champions from this scientific scaling perspective is the heavyweight, despite the fact that he lifted more than anyone else. 6. More misleading conclusions and misconceptions of scale. Drug dosages from LSD and elephants to Tylenol and babies. The role of size and scale pervades medicine and health, even though the ideas and conceptual framework inherent in scaling laws are not explicitly integrated into the biomedical professions. For example, we are all very familiar with the idea that there are standard charts showing how height, growth rate, food intake, and even the circumference of our waists should correlate with our weight, or how these metrics should change during our early development. These charts are none other than representations of scaling laws that have been deemed applicable to the average healthy human being. Indeed, doctors are trained to recognize how such variables should, on average, be correlated with the weight and age of their patients. Also well known is the related concept of an invariant quantity, such as our pulse rate or body temperature, which does not change systematically with the weight or height of the average healthy individual. Indeed, substantial deviations from these invariant averages are routinely used in the diagnosis of disease or ill health. Having a body temperature of 101 degrees Fahrenheit or a blood pressure of 275 over 154 is a signal that something's wrong. These days, a standard physical examination results in a plethora of such metrics that your doctor uses to assess the state of your health. A major challenge of the medical and health industry is to ascertain the quantifiable baseline scale of life, and, consequently, the extended suite of metrics for the average healthy human being, including how large a variation or deviation from them can be tolerated. Not surprisingly, then, many critical problems in medicine can be addressed in terms of scaling. In later chapters, several important health issues that concern us all, ranging from aging and mortality to sleep and cancer, will be addressed using this framework. Here, however, I first want to whet the appetite by considering some equally important medical issues that involve ideas stemming from Galileo's insight into the tension between the way in which areas and volumes scale. These will reveal how easy it is to form misconceptions that lead to seriously misleading conclusions arising from unconsciously using linear extrapolation. In the development of new drugs, and in the investigation of many diseases, much of the research is conducted on so-called model animals, typically standard cohorts of mice that have been bred and refined precisely for research purposes. of fundamental importance to medical and pharmaceutical research is how results from such studies should be scaled up to human beings in order to prescribe safe and effective dosages or draw conclusions regarding diagnoses and therapeutic procedures. A comprehensive theory of how this can be accomplished has not yet been developed, although the pharmaceutical industry devotes enormous resources to addressing it when developing new drugs. A classic example of some of the challenges and pitfalls is an early study investigating the potentially therapeutic effects of LSD on humans. Although the term psychedelic was already coined by 1957, the drug was almost unknown outside of a specialized psychiatric community in 1962. When the psychiatrist Lewis West, no relation, together with Chester Pierce at the University of Oklahoma, and Warren Thomas, a zoologist at the Oklahoma City Zoo, proposed investigating its effects on elephants. Elephants? Yes, elephants. And, in particular, Asiatic elephants. Although it may sound somewhat eccentric to use elephants rather than mice as the model for studying the effects of LSD, there were some not entirely implausible reasons for doing so. It so happens that Asiatic elephants periodically undergo an unpredictable transition from their normal, placid, obedient state to one in which they become highly aggressive and even dangerous for periods of up to 2 weeks. West and his collaborators speculated that this bizarre and often destructive behavior, known as must, was triggered by the auto-production of LSD in elephants' brains. So, the idea was to see if LSD would induce this curious condition, and if so, thereby gain insight into LSD's effects on humans from studying how they react. Pretty weird, but maybe not entirely unreasonable. However, this immediately raises an intriguing question: how much LSD should you give an elephant? At that time, little was known about safe dosages of LSD. Although it had not yet entered the popular culture, it was known that even dosages of less than a quarter milligram would induce a typical acid trip for a human being, and that a safe dose for cats was about one-tenth of a milligram per kilogram of body weight. The investigators chose to use this latter number to estimate how much LSD they should give to Tusco the elephant, their unsuspecting subject that resided at the Lincoln Park Zoo in Oklahoma City. Tusco weighed about 3,000 kilograms, so using the number known to be safe for cats, they estimated that a safe and appropriate dose for Tusco would be about 0.1 milligram per kilogram multiplied by 3,000 kilograms, which comes out to 300 milligrams of LSD. The amount they actually injected was 297 milligrams. Recall that a good hit of LSD for you and me is less than a quarter milligram. The results on Tusco were dramatic and catastrophic. To quote directly from their paper, 5 minutes after the injection, he, the elephant, trumpeted, collapsed, fell heavily onto his right side, defecated, and went into status epilepticus. Poor old Tusco died 1 hour and 40 minutes later. Perhaps almost as disturbing as this awful outcome was that the investigators concluded that elephants are, proportionally, very sensitive to LSD. The problem, of course, is something we've already stressed several times, namely the seductive trap of linear thinking. The calculation of how big a dosage should be used on Tusco was based on the implicit assumption that effective and safe dosages scale linearly with body weight, so that the dosage per kilogram of body weight was presumed to be the same for all mammals. The 0.1 milligram per kilogram of body weight obtained from cats was therefore naively multiplied by Tusco's weight, resulting in the outlandish estimate of 297 milligrams, with disastrous consequences. Exactly how doses should be scaled from one animal to another is still an open question that depends, to varying degrees, on the detailed properties of the drug and the medical condition being addressed. However, regardless of details, an understanding of the underlying mechanism by which drugs are transported and absorbed into specific organs and tissues needs to be considered in order to obtain a credible estimate. Among the many factors involved, metabolic rate plays an important role. Drugs like metabolites and oxygen are typically transported across surface membranes, sometimes via diffusion and sometimes through network systems. As a result, the dose-determining factor is to a significant degree constrained by the scaling of surface areas rather than the total volume or weight of an organism. And these scale non-linearly with weight. A simple calculation using the two-thirds scaling rule for areas as a function of weight shows that a more appropriate dose for elephants should be closer to a few milligrams of LSD rather than the several hundred that were actually administered. Had this been done, Tusco would no doubt have lived, and a vastly different conclusion about the effects of LSD would have been drawn. The lesson is clear. The scaling of drug dosages is non-trivial, and a naive approach can lead to unfortunate results and mistaken conclusions, if not done correctly with due attention being paid to the underlying mechanism of drug transport and absorption. It is clearly an issue of enormous importance, sometimes even a matter of life and death. This is one of the main reasons it takes so long for new drugs to obtain approval for their general use. Lest you think this was some fringe piece of research, the paper on elephants and LSD was published in one of the world's most highly regarded and prestigious journals, namely, Science. Many of us are very familiar with the problem of how drug doses should be scaled with body weight from having dealt with children with fevers, colds, earaches, and other such vagaries of parenting. I recall many years ago being quite surprised when trying to console a screaming infant struggling in the middle of the night with a high fever to discover that the recommended dose of baby Tylenol, printed on the label of the bottle, scaled linearly with body weight. Being familiar with the tragic story of Tusco, I felt a certain degree of concern. The label had a small chart on it showing how big a dose should be given to a baby of a given age and weight. For example, for a 6-pound baby, the recommended dose was 1/4 teaspoon, 40 milligrams, whereas for a baby of 36 pounds, 6 times heavier, the dose was 1 1/2 teaspoons, 240 milligrams, exactly 6 times larger. However, if the nonlinear two-thirds power scaling law is followed, the dosage should only have been increased by a factor of 6 to the 2/3. Around 3.3, corresponding to 132 milligrams, which is just over half of the recommended dose. So, if the 1/4 teaspoon recommended for the 6-pound baby is correct, then the dose of 1 1/2 teaspoons recommended for the 36-pound baby was almost twice too large. Hopefully this has not been putting children at risk, but I have noticed in more recent years that such a chart no longer appears on the bottle or on the pharmaceutical company website. However, the website still shows such a chart indicating linear scaling for the recommended dosages for infants from 36 to 72 pounds, although they now wisely recommend that a physician be consulted for babies less than 36 pounds, less than 2 years old. Nevertheless, other reputable websites still recommend linear scaling for babies younger than this. 7. BMI, Ketele, the average man, and social physics. Another important medical issue related to scale is the use of the body mass index, BMI, as a proxy for body fat content, and by extrapolation, as an important metric of health. This has become very topical in recent years because of its ubiquitous use in the diagnosis of obesity and its association with many deleterious health issues, including hypertension, diabetes, and heart disease. although introduced more than 150 years ago by the Belgian mathematician Adolphe Quetelet as a simple means of classifying sedentary individuals, BMI has taken on a powerful authority among physicians and the general public, despite its somewhat murky theoretical underpinnings. Until the 1970s and the rise of its popularity, the BMI was actually known as the Quetelet Index. Although trained as a mathematician, Quetelet was a classic polymath who contributed to a wide range of scientific disciplines, including meteorology, astronomy, mathematics, statistics, demography, sociology, and criminology. His major legacy is the BMI, but this was just a very small part of his passion for bringing serious statistical analysis and quantitative thinking to problems of societal interest. Quetelet's goal was to understand the statistical laws underlying social phenomena, such as crime, marriage, and suicide rates, and to explore their interrelationships. His most influential book, published in 1835, was On Man and the Development of His Faculties, or Essays on Social Physics. The title was shortened for the English translation to the much more grandiose-sounding Treatise on Man. In the book, he introduces the term social physics and describes his concept of the average man, l'homme moyen. This concept is very much in the spirit of our earlier discussion concerning Galileo's argument on how the strength of the mythical average person scales with his or her weight and height, or the idea that there are meaningful average baseline values for physiological characteristics such as our body temperature and blood pressure. The average man and woman is characterized by the values of the various measurable physiological and social metrics, averaged over a sufficiently large population sample. These include everything from heights and lifespans to the numbers of marriages, the amount of alcohol consumed, and the rates of disease. However, Quetelet brought something new and important to these analyses.